Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
The Yield Disruptors, the biggest names in business, culture, and politics. Hear how successful influencers scored big and became the movers and shakers, pushing everything forward. Gain from their insight and advice, and avoid the setbacks that might keep you from achieving your true potential. Don't forget to rate us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and leave a review if you enjoy the content. This is the Yield Disruptors.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Yield Street's Disruptors podcast, where we sit down with industry leaders and disruptors to discuss how they've reimagined and changed their industries and the leadership skills necessary to create new business opportunities. Today, we are joined by Anthony Scaramucci, the founder and managing partner of SkyBridge, a global alternative investment fund, and the founder and chairman of SALT, a global thought leadership forum and venture studio. Anthony, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to have you here today.
It's great to be on, you know. And just so everybody knows, I, unlike Michael, I didn't change my lighting before we started. And even though Michael accused me of having facial work done, I've only had Botox. So I just wanted to get those questions out of the way before we started anything else. But go ahead, Michael.
So we're going to dig back into the fact checking.
But by the way, as of right now, you don't need any Botox, but when you do, you'll come to my dermatologist. I'll set you up.
I appreciate it. We're going to do a little fact-checking mid-conversation here and go back into that. But let's kick it off and get started. Anthony, I want you to tell us about just your background, where you come from, what inspires you to be you, and then we'll get into SkyBridge and SALT.
Well, I mean, you know, listen, I mean, like you, I'm a Long Islander. So, you know, we're a little crazy. I mean, there's like something in the water out of Long Island. We're all hustling. I mean, probably, I don't know if you did this, but I had like a cooler with beer. I was selling beer on Jones Beach. I got fined by the cops because I didn't have a permit. I obviously didn't have a liquor license. But I stocked shelves as a kid. I worked at my uncle's motorcycle shop. I had a Newsday paper route. I used to go door to door. I convinced, you know, Mr. Fusco, may his soul rest in peace, to give me free papers. And I went door to door to the Dolphin Green Apartments in Port Washington, where there was like, you know, middle class people. And I was dropping off papers to my mom's friends, and I was guilting them into subscribing to a daily subscription to the paper, that sort of thing. My dad was a crane operator, had a great job, hourly worker, but it was a high wage back in the 60s and 70s and 80s. That was a time when you could have a skill like that and actually raise a family in a middle-class neighborhood. Now, you know, we had one full bathroom in the house and we had a couple small bedrooms, but it was a great upbringing. I would never dishonor my dad, Michael, by telling you I grew up poor, did not grow up poor. The town I lived in was Port Washington. There was a lot of wealthy people there. You know the town well. So I'm the product of a good public school system. When I went to Tufts, my parents didn't know the difference between Tufts and any other school. When I got to Harvard, the joke in the family was my mother thought it was Harvard Law School. She had no clue. And she was like, well, why would they call it Harvard Law School if it's not in Harvard? I'm like, because it's not called Harvard Law School, Mom. You know. And she's 85 now. We still tease her about that, you know. So this was a blue-collar people, family of immigrants. Grandfather was a coal miner in northeastern Pennsylvania. My other grandfather was an auto mechanic on Long Island. And let me tell you something. I wouldn't replace my upbringing, as I'm sure you wouldn't,
nope,
for anything in the world. And by the way, you know, I'm politically incorrect, so you'll probably cut this one back. But, you know, my area was Jews, Blacks, Irish, and Italians, okay? And that offered wonderful diversity. You know, wonderful diversity. So we all realized it didn't matter what color we were, what religion we were, we all got along. Sometimes we didn't get along. We beat up on each other indiscriminately. It didn't matter. But it was a great way to grow up, you know.
Came down to hustle, family, and food.
Yeah, that's what it was.
That's it.
And, you know, and here's
I had
thing,
my like, bagel, you know, route. I would, yeah, get one day, of course, I got one day credit, you know, terms from the bagel store. I would take it to,
hey,
school.
Do you remember the flea market? Are you old enough to remember the flea market at Roosevelt Raceway? You're probably not.
Yes. No, I do remember it. And I remember.
Oh, yeah. So I used to sell shit over there too. I mean, you tell me what it was. We were trying to do it because we had no money. And if you're from a blue collar neighborhood, you know what you want? A car. That's what you want. Okay. And that's what I hustled for. I bought my first car from a Sunoco station off the service road at the corner of the Long Island Expressway service road and Roslyn Road. There used to be a Sunoco station there. There was a red 1979 burgundy Camaro. It was a Berlinetta. Okay. Your people could look this thing up. Okay. It had cigarette butt stains everywhere. And, you know, the guy, smoked in the car. You know, I didn't care. I bought the car at 37,000 miles on it. I put a Pioneer stereo in there with the power booster. I had speakers going everywhere, you know, and I used to drive down to Jones Beach with my friends. I mean, that was my upbringing.
So Long Island kid, lot of hustle.
Yeah.
You have neighbors around you that are more affluent, middle class family, comfortable, chip on your shoulder, I want to build something.
I would say the neighbors in the surrounding area were like us. You know, there were landscapers, sheetrock installers, plumbers, electricians. But, you know, Port Washington North, like heading into Sands Point, then you had doctors and lawyers and Wall Streeters and people that were using
success
Port
around
Washington.
You, right? Like, exactly, you were able to taste success nearby, and you wanted a
no
piece
question.
Of it.
I used to ride my bicycle down into Sands Point and look at those houses and say, "Man, and
just keep
American
bike
dream."
That's right.
Someday I'm going to own one of those houses, you know. And then, you know, I got the opportunity to do that, obviously. So that was a blessing. But, you know, I'm going to say something that you'll get because you're from the neighborhood. Okay, you're from that genre. Hustle, food, love. I mean, that's it. You know that. I know that, right? And this is for people that may be going through their first bear market. This is my ninth bear market. It helps you reframe and reset your priorities. What are those for me? It's my family, the mishpoka, la familia. It's my making sure I take care of the people I love, and it's staying close to people and caring about people. And if you do that, you're going to have a great life. You're not... You know, I never compare myself to anybody. I don't look to the left or right and say, "Oh, that guy's doing better or worse than me." I don't care. I'm looking forward, competing only with myself. And, you know, it's been a very good life, thank God. You know, and we're blessed guys. You know that.
Absolutely.
You know, we're blessed guys from where we grew up. You know that.
So I'm going to come back to some of the early life components here, but I want to talk about Skybridge and I want to talk about SALT for a little bit. So professionally, you get through school, you go to Harvard, some thought it was Hartford Law School, and tell us about what you've done professionally that brought you to Skybridge and SALT. And I'm going to come back to being a disruptor and how we could take some early lessons and maybe what we could share with others. But for now, tell us a little bit about your professional background.
So, I mean, you know, we all have goals, right? And so I wrote down a whole list of goals when I was about 22 years old. And some of them came to pass, some of them frankly didn't. And that's what happens in your life. But what I wanted to do, I actually thought I was going to practice law, honestly. Otherwise, I wouldn't have gone to law school. And if you had said to me, "Well, what am I going to do? I'm going to open up my own law firm. I'm going to build a law practice and be a lawyer." So I was going to start as a solo lawyer and then build a law firm. Okay. Always wanted to be an entrepreneur. If you said to me, "What was my life's dream?" It was to own my own business. You know, when I was 13 and my dad's hours got cut at the stone dock in the sand mining area, and they cut back his crane operation due to the recession, there was anxiety in the house, you know, because, you know, when you're an hourly worker, the overtime really matters because it could be time and a half or double time. That's really where the extra juice was, you know. And so I remember my family having a little bit of a tightness and my dad having to sharpen the budgetary pencil. And there was anxiety and stress in the house. And I remember saying to myself, "I'm going to own my own business someday. I'm going to try to become financially independent." So I wrote all that down. When I got to law school, I hated it. I only learned two things in law school. Number one, don't be a lawyer. That was like the obvious thing. It was the most glaring thing. And then the second thing was avoid lawsuits. Michael, I have tried to avoid lawsuits in every way, shape, and form because I don't need the aggravation. I'm 58 years old. I have a full head of hair. I'm sure if I was suing everybody, I'd be like a bald eagle. Avoid the lawsuits, okay? So I was at law school, not doing well there because I didn't really like it. I wanted to drop out. You know, the Jews have a monopoly on guilt, like the Jewish mother, but you'd never seen guilt like an Italian mother. Okay. When I told my mother I was dropping out of law school, I was just going to commit suicide. That's the go-to move for the Italian matron. All right. Well, I'm going to commit suicide. Okay. All right, Mike, you're not going
to
commit suicide.
I just want to interject here. My dad is much worse. He was like, you're going to give me a heart attack. You're going to go walk around the rest of your life knowing you killed me because you quit law school.
Right. 100%. Of course he said that to you. And of course it was like burning inside you. Okay. You know that.
For like 30 fucking years.
Right. Of course. Of course that happened to me too. So I wanted to leave law school. My mother flipped. I stayed in law school, but I crossed the river and I went over to the business school career placement area. And I learned about the investment banking, and I got myself a job at Goldman. And so now I'm at Goldman, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do. And, of course, I want to have my own business. So I write down when my school debt is paid from Tufts and Harvard, and I'm no longer in debt to anybody, I'm going to go start my own business. And that's exactly what I did. I paid off that debt Memorial Day, 1996. I was 32 years old. I left Goldman at the end of their fiscal year. And I started my company December 1st, 1996.
And what does your company do?
So at that time, I had a partner by the name of Andrew Bozart. We called it Oscar Capital. So it was Boscar, B-O-S, the first part of his name, S-C-A-R. But we dropped the B and called it Oscar. It was a cute little name. We had a registered investment advisor. We had a small hedge fund. But we were in a bull market, Michael. And you never confuse brains with the bull market. We obviously thought we were a lot smarter than we were, but we made a ton of money in the first 2 years of our operation. Then we got clocked in 98 during the long-term capital management crisis. That was my first real thrashing. And so, you know, my conviction level remained, but I got off leverage back then. And I think that was one of the best things that I did. Newsflash to all your listeners, avoid the leverage. You can have an amazing life. You don't have to be the richest person, but you want to be able to stay in the game. Wall Street is about survivability. You don't want to get flushed out at the bottom and making decisions that you don't want to make as a result of a weak hand, as a result of leverage. And so 98, I made a solemn vow to myself I wouldn't own anything on leverage in my portfolio, and I kept to that.
As a 35-year-old entrepreneur, yeah. Yeah. You had a roughly smooth cruising. You went to Harvard. You went to Goldman. I'm sure you worked your butt off and you fought hard for it every day, but it was a good time. It was a bull run. You get out there. You're green. You start your own business. You call it Oscar, and you get clocked.
Yeah.
Well, do you recall the resilience that you needed to have?
Like, say it again?
Do you recall the resilience that you needed to Do you recall some of those tough days?
Well, that's been a hallmark of my life. I think that resilience is the number one thing, because whether you're going through 98, the 2008 financial crisis, the COVID-19 scare of March and April of 2020, the current bear market debacle of 2022, you have to have a resilience chip in your personality, a gene. It's a stick-to-it-ness. It's an ignorance. And what do I mean by ignorance? You ignore the naysayers. You ignore the babble out there. You drop your self-consciousness. Entrepreneurs cannot afford to be self-conscious. Entrepreneurs can't really afford to listen to the negative trolling that they experience in their life for trying things. You know, Jeff Bezos' stock goes from 116 to 6. He's got blinders on. He's pushing his agenda forward. And lo and behold, he ends up launching himself into outer space with Captain Kirk. The point being is that you just got to stay in it. One of the ways you stay in it is avoiding leverage, buying long-term things that you think are quality, and being patient. And so those are some of the hallmarks of my success. But I will say this. You get lucky, but you're creating your own luck, and you're creating your own luck by being present. If you don't show up, you can't get lucky. So you got to show up. You know, I got very lucky, weird situation. I got invited to the Citibank corporate reception at the Belvedere Hotel, Davos, Switzerland, 2009. And I'm in the hotel and I'm meeting Michael Corbett, who went on to become the CEO. And Michael says to me that he has a fund of funds business that he has to sell because Citibank got TARP money from the federal government and they're now have to dissolve or remove non-core assets. If I wasn't there in that location at that moment, I probably wouldn't have even known about it. I seized the day, bought those assets. That was a big big leg up for me. That was a big move for me in my career.
You got to be present to be lucky.
Have to be present to be lucky. You have to be in the game. 2009, I'm dying. Okay, the NASDAQ is at, I don't know, S&P for sure, I remember, 666 on the S&P. The Dow is at 6,500. It was March 9th, 2009. I was like, oh my God, the Dow is back to like 1996 levels. And I said some gallows humor. I said, well, I was having a good year in 96. Maybe I'll have a good year again. You know, but we were getting annihilated. And I made the decision to start the SALT conference. Why? I actually thought we were going out of business, Michael. And I thought, okay, I need to be in the third-party marketing business for hedge funds. My business is going to go out of business. Let me start a conference that will create some capital introduction activity. And so I started a conference in Las Vegas known as SALT. It mushroomed into the global brand that it is today. We do four of them around the world, but it was all accidental. I was at Seton Hall making a presentation to a group of undergrads. And somebody said to me, well, what was the genius vision to start the SALT conference? And I was like, I wish there was a genius vision. The truth was we were going out of business and I was throwing spaghetti at the wall. That happened to stick. That's true, authentic entrepreneurship.
Okay, I don't see it exactly like that. You weren't just throwing spaghetti at the wall. I think you took a very hard look at your network, your business, your capability, your resilience, your need to provide, and you said, I need to hedge my bet here. What am I really good at? What can I tap into? How do I create value? What is the world missing? It needs a different kind of conference. It can't just continue to be sort of these boring business get-togethers that people dread, but we have to bring real thought leaders. We have to educate folks. We have to make it engaging. We have to make it exciting. And I could bring my flair and my network and leverage that. So I think I want to jump on that because I look at you as more than a typical entrepreneur. I look at you as a disruptor. You follow your gut. You make big moves. You don't listen to the naysayers. You took initiative such as going into the White House in a challenging time. And I constantly follow you and see that your path is sort of against the grind, if you will. Even the most recent announcement with FTX and SALT is showing that you had a long-term vision around crypto and wanted to be at the forefront and wanted to be sort of the category owner of that space. So what I want to focus on today is being a disruptor and being a world-class entrepreneur, especially in this time where we're seeing tremendous volatility. There's a lot of talks of a recession. There's a debate as to how long it's going to be. We always find new entrepreneurs and new disruptors coming to the fore. And I believe that they look to people like you for advice. And so what do you tell your younger self or what do you tell the next generation of disruptors who are on the fence thinking about, is this my time?
It's great. So I'm gonna start with a little bit of an allegory, which I think you'll get, and then I'll tie it back. So the first thing I would say is don't take advice from people, because what ends up happening is the people give you advice pursuant to their life, and they're trying to impose their decision-making on you. I never do that. I always look at what the entrepreneur wants and then try to help them with a thought model to help them get what they want, as opposed to me saying, well, go left because I went right and that failed, and go right because that succeeded for me, and don't go left. That sort of thing I never do. But here's something I will say to you, okay? I was in my office. It was the Great Bull Run of 1997. I was making a lot of money. People knew about it. And one of my colleagues from Goldman Sachs came up to my office to see me. They said, oh, this was so smart of you to leave. Obviously, we didn't know if it was going to be smart or not. I got lucky. And he looked at me and said, I want to leave. I'm going to go do the same thing you did. And I looked at him. I said, okay, that's great. I said, can I show you where my summer house is? He said, oh, yeah, you have a summer house? Yes, yeah, please show me where your summer house is. I said, okay, great, come with me. And I walked him to the computer closet. Server closet. I opened the door. It was over $1 million worth of servers. This is 1997, right? Because we had trading operation and servers connecting into Goldman and Morgan Stanley and everywhere. And I said, okay, this is my summer house. Okay, so if you're willing to put your summer house in a server closet, then you should leave and you should go start this business. Okay. By the way, it costs you 10 grand for the Pitney Bowes machine. That's to mail out the stuff. That's a whole other thing, but go ahead and leave. But if you're not ready to do that, you're not willing to do that, then you should never leave. The point being is this shit is way harder than people think it is when they get it started. To quote Frederick W. Smith, one of the most successful entrepreneurs ever, the founder of FedEx and has been running FedEx for 50 years, and a friend of mine, Fred Smith, said to me, if I knew how hard it was to start FedEx, I never would have started FedEx. The point being,
it's when you said before an entrepreneur needs to have ignorance, that's where I thought you were going. I think if any of us knew the fight we'd have to put in to start, there's no way we would. I agree with that 100%.
No way. That's where we're going, you know, and that's where we are basically, you know.
So I've been to your office. I've met a lot of people that work with you. I've met a lot of people that work for you. You have a great culture. I would define your culture as...
Sweet of you to say that. Thank you.
It's true. You're welcome. Listen, I think that if there's one thing that's really a reflection of leadership, it's the culture and it's the people that work for that company. If I would put into my words how I felt about being in your office, and you know, for those of us who are going to be watching this as opposed to listening, you can even see a little bit behind Anthony. It's an environment that encourages people to speak up. It's an environment that encourages people to be creative, to think differently. It's an environment that I think people feel comfortable failing fast and trying things that may or may not work. But when you hit your stride, you go at it hard and you go deep. One of the most important things, in my opinion, to building an amazing business is to be able to build the right culture for your organization. And not asking folks how to build the same culture as you did, because that may not be what they need for their business. But any tips on how to focus on building the right culture, on being the culture ambassador?
Really, really good question. So first of all, I'm flattered that you say that. It means a lot to me because I really care about the people here. I would say a couple of things. I would say, number one, watch your pronouns. Me, I, very bad in a corporate culture. We, our, collaboration, not competition, all good stuff. I run the company. I'm the managing partner. I have the controlling voting shares of the company, but this is a collaboration. Nobody works for me, Michael. I never say, oh, that guy works for me or that woman works for me. I'm their boss. I say that the person works with me. See, the distinction is very important to me because that's how you get more out of people. They feel empowered. They feel included and they don't feel demeaned when you talk like that. We serve free lunch here. I mean, I'm an Italian. What do Jews and Italians like? Food. So we serve free lunch. There's an espresso machine. There's a kegerator of cold brew, okay, in the pantry, free lunch, free snacks, create a good environment. If you stay late, you get a ride home from us. We match everybody's 401k maximum allowable by law in terms of the profit sharing. It is stuff like that we're doing that I think makes the culture. You know, I have never taken a dollar from anybody for healthcare expenses, not me. Okay, I used to be upset about that at Goldman. Like, okay, this is a rich, profitable company. Forget about me. I'm making good money at Goldman. I can afford the deduction. What about the assistant, you know, taking money out of the girl's pay or the guy's pay? You know, so I never did that. And I think that's allowed people, my chief administrative officer here, 29 years, my general counsel, 21 years, my head of sales started the firm with me. You know, I mean, that's how you keep people, and that's how people want to stay in good times and bad, you know, I mean, because we've had some bad times, you know, and that's the most painful thing for me. I've had growth in the business and I've had to lay people off in the business. And those are the sad parts for me, is laying people off, you know. And I've also had a situation, people have left, they call me back and, wow, this, I didn't realize how good it was here. I'm over here at this other firm and these people don't treat me like you did. I'd like to come back, you know? And in some cases, I let them come back. In other cases, I say, okay, yeah, but enjoy yourself over there. You know what I'm saying? You know, because some of these people are just young kids and they're naive to what's going on really in the world. Does that make sense?
It does. I think for me, one of the most rewarding things is seeing people that come back. I always like to tell people from time to time, you can't say goodbye from Yale Street for too long. We have a pattern of folks coming back. And I agree. I think that a lot of people, especially under 40, under 45, haven't really had to experience different cycles in the market. They're being poached all the time and they're trying new experiences. And, you know, then they leave and they realize that the place they left was a lot better than they had given it credit to.
So that's a tribute to you, a compliment to what you guys are building. And I think you have to think like, and I know those, and also, man, come on, I'm not in it for the last buck. I don't need to be the richest guy in the graveyard. I need to make sure that the people here feel valued, well compensated. I also need to make sure my clients know that we're working our hardest that we can for them. We're but we're also trying to break new ground. If you're going into crypto, you're going to have some volatility. It's interesting. It was 7 short months ago, Michael, I was a hero to my clients because Bitcoin was at 69,000 and they were praising me. Bitcoin's at 19,000 and they're pissed at me, praising and pissed. But they're staying with me because, you know, I've conditioned them and treat them with respect. And I try to make sure that they think about these things from a long-term perspective.
So I want to go into that a little bit. You've been through a number of market cycles. You've worked at places like Goldman and been an entrepreneur for a while. You've managed money for major institutions, U.S.-based, international. You've managed money for people, for individuals. You have a very good way of articulating complicated topics in an easy-to-understand fashion. So you got a whole bunch of people here listening today trying to make sense of the volatility in the market as it stands in June of 2022. What do you tell people who are what I would call frozen? They just don't know what to make of this market right now. You got inflation. You can't do nothing. So, you're going to eat away at your cash. What do you do?
So, you know, I mean, I'm the wrong guy for this because the way I have made my money is with a stick-to-itness, you know. So I have ridden out bear markets. I have added money in bear markets. I have averaged down or in bear markets. So I'm not the best person to talk to about this because I think people have too much friction in their accounts. And so there was a great article I put out on Twitter the other day. The topic was, do dead people's accounts do better than living people? And the answer is yes, they do. You know, Charles Schwab did this whole study. I have it on my Twitter feed. And why do they do better? Because the person's dead. They're not looking at their account. And I think, you know, sometimes you have to buy quality, stay in quality, and be patient. And so do we have inflation? Yes. How bad is the inflation? Is it 1970 style inflation? I don't believe that. We have too much great innovative technology that we're onboarding that is classically deflationary. The reason why the inflation of the 70s and the early 80s didn't stick, the internet brought it down, you know, and we always have a tendency to think linearly about something when our minds need to think exponentially. You know, Thomas Malthus, if you're an economist listening, you know who he is. He was in the 1840s. He wrote a treatise that said that very bad news to the world. We're going to starve to death. Our populations are growing exponentially. We can only grow the food linearly. We're going to starve. It was a Malthusian proposition. But he got it wrong because he missed vertical farming. He missed genetically modified foods. He missed irrigation, all the technical wizardry that we've applied to agriculture. Michael, we have more people dying from obesity-related illnesses than we do from starvation. And so the point being is world is changing very rapidly. The markets sometimes won't catch up to it. You know, to me, the inflation is based on the induction of heavy money into the money supply, combined with a disrupted supply chain with an added feature of an Eastern European war with one of the world's largest energy suppliers struggling. Those three things have tipped off exogenous inflation, certainly not transitory, but I don't believe it's systemic. I think these numbers will come down before the end of the year, and I think there's now a specter of a recession. I don't see how the Fed avoids it, frankly, and they'll have to start cutting rates by the end of the year. That's what I honestly think. And you know the market will rally on that. So you can sit here today in the doldrums. Remember, all states in the universe are impermanent and we're always changing. And we're in a downward cycle right now, but we will go back into an upward cycle. Why get juked out of things? Stay patient, buy quality, and keep your eye on the long term. Don't be focused on the short term. I watch buddies of mine hopefully your people are listening. I'm going to literally grab them by the throat and shake them a little bit. I watched buddies of mine give up on tech March of 2000. NASDAQ, kaboom, 5,400 to 2,300. Amazon, 116 to 6. I'm done. I'll never touch another tech stock again. Well, you know what? They would have missed a 22-year run in tech that was arguably the most fascinating bull run of all time. They would have missed the investment sector of their generation because they got burnt at a hot stove known as the dot-com bubble or the dot-com crash of March of 2000. So I just want to apply perspective to these things for people. My 34th year in the industry, ninth bear market. See things through to the other side. Stay calm. Be disciplined. You don't need the extra house. You don't need the extra watch. You're not impressing anybody with your car. By the way, I love cars. I got a couple of them. Probably will sell one of them here just so I don't look like a jackass driving around in all of them. But the point is, you don't have to be the guy. You just want to be a good guy. Does that make sense?
I think it does. If I would summarize it, it's stay calm, pay attention on the sphere of influence that you could control.
Yes.
This isn't the first time. It won't be the last. Bet on America. Bet on yourself. Things will get better. Buy smart. Buy right.
Right. Exactly.
I like it all. So just leaving the investment world behind and just back on the broader entrepreneur and disruptor, you decide to ditch the world of finance for a minute and take center stage at the White House.
Yeah.
What were you thinking? Why? What was it?
Well, there was some stupidity in my decision making, but you know, let me frame it for you. And it probably sound defensive, but I don't mean to be, because it was certainly one of the stupidest things I've ever done. But let me just go back and frame it for you. I got into politics because I had no network. Okay, my dad wore, you know, we call it a greenie. He had a green uniform on. It was loaded with grease. He took it off at the end of the day, put it in a safety clean drum, and they cleaned it for him, you know? So I didn't have any connectivity into the corporate world. I never saw the inside of a country club. I never swung a golf club or a tennis racket. And so I'm at Goldman. I'm trying to meet wealthy people. I'm in the high net worth area. I went into politics. I thought that was the best way to meet influential people. So I wrote my first check to Rudy Giuliani, Young Republicans for Rudy. He lost the election in 89. I'm 25 years old. He won in 93. That was an amazing thing for me when he won in 93. Now I've got access. I got a great parking sticker, by the way. I could like literally park on a fire hydrant. I'm meeting so many different people. He introduces me to Pataki. And then Rudy being Rudy Meshuggah, okay, he goes and endorses Mario Cuomo. He endorses Andrew and Chris's dad. In the meantime, he's a Republican. So, I mean, it was typical Rudy, right? So now I'm working with Pataki. Pataki wins. I'm doing very well in Republican Party fundraising up until George Bush's brother Jeb leaves the race in 2016, February. He loses the South Carolina primary, pulls out of the race. Donald Trump looks like he's now going to win. He calls to recruit me. Mistake number one of the colossal mistakes. I say yes to that. I wasn't with Trump in the beginning, didn't take him seriously. We knew each other, but I didn't take it seriously, but I decided to go work for him. So that was my ego, Mike. Ultimately, your ego and your pride will be your enemy. I said, okay, this guy's exciting. I'm going to be flying around on his plane. I'm going to learn a lot about the country. I'm going to go do this, even though he is not saying the right things. He's not using the right rhetoric. Then mistake number two, I thought he was going to lose. He wins. He names me to the executive transition team without even telling me, because that's classic Trump. I'm on the couch at Fox and Friends, and all of a sudden coming across the zipper, you know, Scaramucci among 16 people named to the executive transition team. I'm like, the Brian Kilmeade, the anchor, is asking me, well, how does it feel to be named to the transition team? I'm like, you know, I answered it with some pablum. And then I called Trump on the cell phone. I said, are you crazy? Ha, 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 ho, ho, ho. I'm your president now. You're going to come work for me. And then Rice Priebus blocked my job. I was supposed to be his chief networking officer, supposed to be in the OPL area. And this is where I really made my mistake. I called Trump and said, Reince and Steve are bad guys. You're going to want to get rid of them. When you want to get rid of them, call me. I'll take care of it for you. Very stupid. That was ego-driven. That was pride-driven. and it was very, very stupid. And so on the 20th of July, a Thursday, he calls me. He says, what are you doing? I said, what am I doing? He says, come meet me in the Oval Office. He's the president of the United States, Mike. What do you think I was going to do? Did I go meet him in the Oval Office?
You suit up and go. 100%.
I flew down there. I met him in the Oval Office, 4 o'clock meeting. You were right about these guys. I want you to come work for me. Now my ego intoxicated, right? My wife hates Trump almost as much as Melania hates him. I mean, it's really close. I mean, almost as much. And so she's telling me not to do it, but no, no, no. My ego, my pride, or my enemy, I say yes. So now I go into the hornet's nest. Priebus and Bannon are trying to kill me. They're leaking all kinds of fake news garbage about me. I then make a mistake with a reporter from Long Island, an Italian kid I trust. I said something really funny about Bannon. I thought it was off the record, like you and I talking off the record. He said, oh, you didn't technically say it was off the record. He recorded me and he ran to CNN with the tape. And what do you think happened to me? I got fired. And I told him, I said, you know, you're going to get me fired. Our families have been friends for 50 years. My dad knows your dad. You're going to get me fired. Why would you do that to me? Why make this so transactional? Well, it's a good news story. And he was trying to make a name for himself. So he put that out there. I got fired. So you know what? My mistake, my bad. I should have never done it. I should have stuck to the knitting of my business as an entrepreneur. But you said something that I thought was interesting. You know, I'm a risk taker. I want to try new things. Look at my life experience as a result of doing that, right? I have much higher profile. These conferences, I think, have been made better by that because I'm able to reach more people because I'm more well-known. I just did the British show, which is now going to be on primetime in America, called Celebrity Special Forces. I was in the Jordanian desert with Dwight Howard, Mike Piazza, Danny Amendola, Carly Lloyd, the woman Olympic soccer player. We were running through a Navy SEAL British SAS survival course for 10 days. I'm not getting that
gig.
And
you still want us to believe you only got 2 shots of Botox?
No, I got a lot of Botox. I got more Botox. Let me tell you something, okay? You better be nice to me because your wife's going to need Botox, and I've cornered the North American market on Botox. Most of the Botox drums are in my garage because I'm a little bit of a hoarder.
This is where the supply chain issues are stemming from. Scaramucci's garage. Exactly.
You better make sure. You better be nice to me because your wife's going to be like, there's no Botox available, and Mooch has got it in his garage. You better be nice to him.
So let's say we're going a bit long.
I'm 58 years old. They made me run up the Jordanian Hashemite Tower with a 30-pound backpack. I dropped the backpack, jumped out the damn window, and rappelled off the side of the tower. So to me, that was an amazing life experience. I'm not getting that if I didn't make the mistake of going into the White House. So it was a mistake. It was inducted by my ego. It's regrettable. My lesson to your podcast listeners and viewers, try not to let your ego influence your decision-making. It's very bad for you if you do that. Okay, but having said that, I did survive it. Resiliency, don't take yourself that seriously. You don't have to read the negative press clippings. Lean into it. Steve Colbert asked me, hey, do you think you were going to last longer than 11 days in the White House? I'm like, yeah. I thought it was going to last longer than a carton of milk in the refrigerator. I didn't think I was going to get blown out before the milk spoiled. You know, the point being, you got to take it. You know, they put me on Saturday Night Live, and it was Christmas 2017, and Alec Baldwin had an ornament with my face on it, and he was playing Donald Trump, and Trump had a Christmas tree of love and he had a Christmas tree of hate. And there was my little head on an ornament about to be put on the Christmas tree of hate. And as they were doing it, what do you think they did? They panned into the audience and they saw me there. Of course, I was bright red, red like a cherry tomato, and the whole audience screamed and clapped and everything. And I waved. What are they going to do? You got to own your shit, my man. You know, good, bad, and the ugly. And I think people appreciate that.
I think the lessons were key, Anthony. You started out politically because you were super calculated about how to expand your business and how to expand your network and how to gain influence. As any successful entrepreneur, you tripped up on your ego. We all do. The key is try to catch it next time. So I think for all the people that are listening here, learn from Anthony's mistakes, learn from my mistakes, learn from every entrepreneur, and try to keep yourself in check before your ego gets to you. Anthony, thank you for joining us today. This was an incredible conversation. I had a lot of fun.
You asked great questions, and it's great to be on.
Thank you. Look forward to our listeners subscribing to our show. Please rate us on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, Google, and we'll see you here next week. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.